Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Postal Service is on the brink of default. It's hemorrhaging money, and its core businesses are collapsing. People are turning to UPS, to FedEx. They're communicating by email, Twitter, and Facebook. They're paying bills online. Many Americans still want their U.S. mail. Will they get it? In what form? Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe before a Senate committee last week? Not so sure.
The Postal Service is at the brink of default. Our situation is urgent. Mr. Chairman, the Postal Service requires radical changes to its business model if it is to remain viable into the future.
This hour, On Point, the U.S. Postal Service on the brink. Could we? Should we? Will we live without it or with a very different U.S. mail? You can join the conversation. Do you need it just as it is? What changes could you picture? What if it went away? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Ed O'Keefe, Federal Eye columnist for The Washington Post. He's been closely following the travails of the post office. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
So there was a September 30th deadline to deliver something like $5 billion. The post office says, please, please, we can't do it. What's happening?
Yeah, the fiscal year for the Postal Service and the entire federal government is ends on September 30th. And at the end of each fiscal year, they owe about $5.5 billion to pre-fund the future retirements of future workers. A bit confusing, but a few years ago, back in 2006, Congress essentially required them to help to make these payments to sort of pay in advance for future costs, because at the time, mail volume was in great shape, as was the economy.
Mail volume, that is the number of pieces they were delivering, which fell off a cliff along with the rest of the economy. It fell off
indeed.
A cliff.
And so they're asking Congress for about 3 extra months, and the White House is in support of this idea, to not only allow them to come up with the money, but also work with Congress to come up with a solution to fix long simmering financial problems. Not only is mail volume off a cliff, but labor costs are skyrocketing and account for 80% of their costs.
Ed, why shouldn't they pre-fund retirement? I mean, isn't the failure to do that why so many state, local, federal government agencies around the country are in trouble now?
Yeah, the Postal Service doesn't have a problem with pre-funding. The problem is the amount of money they have to pay, $5.5 billion. They'd rather pay maybe just $1 billion. And the unions that they work with obviously are in support of pre-funding, but not at that huge cost because it's basically making them go broke every year. And the $5.5 billion is basically there to help pay for the bill that was passed back in 2006. They have to make these payments through 2016. The problem is the Postal Service may not exist by 2016, the way mail volume is going and these costs are adding up.
Does the whole thing, as a public service, we very well understand it, and people are very deeply attached to it, and many businesses depend on it. But what's the sense in Washington now? There's such a, we've been in such a cost-cutting fever. I mean, is there support for the U.S. Postal Service, or are people seriously saying, maybe not?
No, there's definitely an attitude this year of getting something done because, as you said, the politics have shifted in such a way that because they're cutting costs everywhere else, they might as well cut costs at the Postal Service as well and reorganize this. Postal officials have been warning about this for at least 3 years. Congress has virtually ignored them every year around this time when they get to the end of their fiscal year. But because the super committee is getting to work on government spending cuts, and because, as you said, state and local governments are thinking about it, there's politically now an appetite to do this because I think lawmakers understand, A, the Postal Service as it exists may, cease to exist, but also that because, the American public wants spending cuts and government to be acting more responsibly when it comes to its finances, that they might as well work on the Postal Service right now, too.
What would the Postmaster General like to do, other than getting this big break on the $5 billion? What else would he like to do to get things?
Sure, and that's actually the thing he wants the most and the one that customers don't really comprehend. But what he wants when it comes to things that you and I see and think about when it comes to the post office, mm-hmm. he wants to end Saturday mail deliveries, which would save them about $3 billion a year.
Okay.
He wants the ability to close post offices without having to go to Congress each time. They're looking at a few thousand different locations across the country that they would close, and that also would help them save a few billion dollars a year. Of course, the problem is that far-flung rural areas or post offices located in urban areas might close, making it a little difficult for you and I to find somewhere to stop by and mail a package. But
yep.
While they do that, they want to be able to move into places like Walmart or Office Depot or the neighborhood supermarket and set up a kiosk there where you could buy some forever stamps, maybe mail a priority mail package, drop off an envelope, and also pick up your groceries or clothing or whatever else you might be doing as you shop.
And he wants layoffs.
He does. He's seeking about 120,000 layoffs, and that would require breaking some labor contracts. So that he's got to go to Congress and ask them to allow them to break these contracts. What some lawmakers have said already is, look, you just negotiated a new multi-year deal back in May with your largest union. Why didn't you take care of this yourself back then? And the argument that the Postal Service is making is that the situation's gotten even worse since May. We're now going to lose as much as $10 billion this fiscal year. Just a few months ago, we were thinking it was just $7 billion. Union's not happy about this, but
yeah.
they believe that if they can lay off about 120,000 workers, get down to about 425,000 postal workers nationwide, that that's a more manageable size going into the future.
Well, 120,000 layoffs. I mean, they cut the deal in May, and here we are. It's only September, not even the middle of September. The American Postal Workers Union president calls that outrageous, illegal, and despicable. But there's that $10 billion loss looking at us. Are they likely to get the extension to the end of the year, a little bit beyond, to work on this, Ed?
Well, lawmakers just introduced it yesterday. It's still not entirely clear where everyone stands on this. This is a very tricky issue for lawmakers because, you know, you talk to their constituent services people, the folks who handle questions and requests made by voters back home. One of the top issues they hear about on a regular basis has to do with the mail. It's a very sensitive issue because if you go around possibly closing post offices in their neighborhoods, in their districts, in their states, you know, lawmakers obviously hear about it and they get blamed, even though they're not the one making that decision. So voting on this issue can be tricky, but, you know, overall, there is an attitude, there is an appetite that this is the year to make it happen. I suspect in the end, with all the other talks about spending cuts going on in Washington, that yes, giving themselves a three-month window to work on this is something that lawmakers would be okay with, and they could wrap it into all those other super committee discussions.
Big stakes, a lot on the table for the U.S. Mail. Ed O'Keefe is with the Washington Post, spoke with us from Washington. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. Great to be with you.
Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe right there before Senate committee last week, responding here to a question from Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who asked if the post office is in a death spiral.
I think that failure to act on a number of these issues to get stable will result in a death spiral. I think that if we continue to just try to make incremental changes without going in with one fell swoop and making some big changes, we'll cause every year we'll be in a situation where we're reporting losses. So you got to make those cuts and move on from there.
What would it mean for the country? Here's Maine Senator Susan Collins.
The failure of the Postal Service would be devastating to our economy. I see you're nodding in agreement. It would pose a threat to the jobs of millions of Americans.
Aye, said a lot of other senators. Here's Tom Carper of Delaware.
If the Postal Service were to fail, the impact on our economy would be dramatic. As Postmaster General Donahue and others have pointed out time and time again, the Postal Service operates at the center of an industry that employs millions of people. These men and women don't just work at the Postal Service. They work at magazines, at banks, at printing companies, and in businesses large and small across America.
Joining me now from Washington is Robert Reasoner. He worked on the leadership team at the U.S. Postal Service from 93 to 01, first as vice president charged with creating a digital strategy, then as vice president of strategic planning. They could use some of that. He's now president of the consulting firm Transformation Strategy. Robert Reasoner, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Everything on the line, default we're hearing about, death spiral we're hearing about. I mean, could this really go away, or will it survive without some big transformation?
Well, I think big transformation and the kind of radical changes that Postmaster General Donahoe has proposed, that Senate committee gave him credit for putting forward some unpleasant but very bold initiatives. And I think what he said there is that radical change is going to be needed over the long term. But in the short term, it's very important for the Postal Service and for the country to be given the time to adapt.
Well, it's not as though we haven't seen these problems brewing for some time. I mean, you were there years ago, and that adaptation still hasn't taken place. Can it, in a system where, you know, it's responsible for its own bottom line, But it's all wrapped up in legislation from congressmen who never want to take a hit in their district.
Well, there's no question that Congress and the Postal Service, the administration, need to show leadership here and find a way past a very difficult set of problems. But it's important, Tom, to remember that what we're talking about here was a 20% volume drop in just a couple of years.
With the economic collapse.
Exactly. That precipitated the crisis, but it still means that there's 150 billion, 170 billion pieces of mail that are moving through that system, and it's important to find a way to adjust. As Senator Collins talked about the rural post offices and how important they are, the country needs time with this democratic institution to find a way to imagine what that future will look like.
Could a country live without a postal service these days? With email and everything else, all the other delivery services, is it still critical? It was great. It was a fantastic innovation. Many people love it. But do we absolutely now need it?
Well, I think what is important to talk about is, when are you looking at? Are you looking at 2020? Are you looking at 2030? I think that the idea that there will be dramatic change and that the physical hard copy mail will be connected to internet services is something that's already taking place. And as that evolves in coming years, I'm sure there will be a dramatic evolution in what we mean by a post office. But in the short term, Tom, I think it's a very important institution and critical to the democracy.
Well, it's all on the line this fall. Robert Reasoner was Vice President of Strategic Planning at the U.S. Postal Service. Mr. Reasoner, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the U.S. Postal Service literally on the brink of default, asking, could we, will we, should we live without the U.S. mail or with a very different postal service? Joining me right now from Washington is Philip Herr. He's Director of Physical Infrastructure Issues for the Government Accountability Office, the GAO. For the past few years, he's focused on problems at the U.S. Postal Service, been looking around the world to see how other countries are doing it. He's advocated some short-term cuts and some broad restructuring. Philip Herr, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
And with me in the studio is Marshall Van Alstyne. He's professor at Boston University's School of Management, research scientist at MIT's Center for Digital Business. He's been thinking a lot as well about the digital future and the place of the Postal Service within that future. Marshall Van Alstyne, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Philip Herr, first to you. On this talk about, you know, default and collapse and death spiral and all the rest, is it as serious as all that?
Well, I think those are all terms that help conjure up the vision of an organization that, despite coming to people's homes 6 days a week and seeing their trucks on the street, et cetera, is in a real serious financial crisis. So, you know, this is the time to take a hard look at what the Postal Service is, what kind of services it provides, and then how we're going to finance it.
So do we still need a U.S. mail in the future we're looking at, where we've got lots of distribution, private companies now, where we've got email and all the rest of the digital realm? First, just to know where you stand on this, I know where a lot of our listeners stand. They're all over the place, but a lot of them want it. But do you think we need it?
Well, I think in the short run, and I think one of your prior guests made the point that it's evolving. There's still a lot of money in the mail, but I think this is also a time to really take a look at where it's going. It is clearly changing. The role the mail plays in communication is changing dramatically. People say whatever can be digitized will be. I mean, the way we communicate in the workplace with our friends is changing dramatically too. So in the short run, this is something that, you know, it's still an important part of American life, but longer term, that whole paradigm is changing dramatically.
Let's look at the future right in front of us. That 44-cent first-class stamp has been the sort of Cadillac of postal delivery, and it's what has made the money for the post office. A lot of other things, the junk mail magazines and all the rest, much lower rates on the delivery of those. Very important to those businesses, obviously. In a way, we're now, some people have said, subsidizing junk mail. But if people aren't writing letters or are sending their personal communications not by first-class mail, what does that do to the finances of the Postal Service?
Well, it creates a significant problem for them, and the first-class mail has been declining dramatically. And I think it's not just the personal letters, but I think more fundamentally it's how financial institutions are interacting with us. You know, many banks, I mean, most people that I talk to say they haven't seen a canceled check in 8 or 10 years. Financial statements from brokerage firms, et cetera. Everything that can be pushed electronically has been, or at least it's in the process of doing that. And then many more people are paying their bills online as well. And that was a big part of the mail stream.
So if we're going to have to restructure it, just to hold it together here, it's that, it looks like, or something akin to what may feel like a big subsidy, I don't know, but how do you do it? Other nations have been doing this already. What have you seen? You've been out looking around Europe, for example. How are they handling their mail?
Right. Well, actually, it's a good point. We did a report earlier this year then talking about six industrialized nations, and I heard in the lead-in that you mentioned alternate sort of places for postal services to be provided. And let me run through a couple, you know, kind of high-level numbers. But, you know, for example, in Germany, only 2% of their post offices are owned by Deutsche Post. The rest of really are through retail partnerships. And you know, here in the U.S., there's actually some of that's happening already. There are, you know, what they call approved shippers, where you can buy postal services. You can buy stamps at pharmacies and grocery stores. So
you mean the post office, there's no longer a post office, or if it is, it's not owned by the state or by the postal service, it's owned by retailers. So what? I go to a gas station or a supermarket to get or send my mail?
To buy a package, to buy a money order. And, for example, in Sweden, I had an opportunity to go there. There at the entrance of a grocery store was a retail counter. There was a clerk there who was selling other kind of things for the store, and when he wasn't selling those things, he was selling postal products.
How does that work around security and dependability? The same kid who handles the cauliflower is going to handle my first-class mail?
Well, in this case, I think he was selling tobacco, but he was standing behind that counter. There's a dedicated spot for the mail. Folks there are trained in terms of, you know, security, and you know, it's in a separate, you know, compartment, so to speak. But the idea there is that providing that service through a standalone post office became too expensive.
And what about delivery of the mail? Do all these industrialized nations on the other side of the pond still have the promise of universal delivery wherever you are within that nation, whenever something's sent to you?
Yeah, they still have a universal service standard. One of the things that they've done, though, they've done some interesting innovations. One thing I found interesting was a delivery point at a train station. Germany's doing this. They call it a pack station. So, you know, here in the Washington, D.C. area, or in, say, in New York City or a place like that, you could go through your train terminal, or you could go to a public spot. It could be a box at a supermarket as well. And you get a text message saying there's a package for you. You go. They give you a code. You go to your box. You pick it up. So rather than come to your home two or three times to try to make that delivery, you simply get the package and you're done. That's a more efficient, easier way to do it, and saves time and money.
And what about all the what we call junk mail, all the marketing that comes through the slot now? How do they handle that in Europe? Do they subsidize the delivery of that to homes?
I think there's fewer mail pieces potentially in some of those countries, but it's the rates there are higher than the rates are here in the United States for postage.
Let's peer a little further into the future. Marshall Van Alstyne, I mean, you look at the digital future when it comes to all the things that we've done with the U.S. mail in the past. Now, a lot of that has changed already. There's much less first-class mail. People aren't sending letters. They're sending email. What does that future hold for the post office? Is there a role longer term for the post office in a digital future? Can they do something? Is there a need, some need that they would fill that everybody else out there in that digital space cannot?
Absolutely, yes. One of the things we want to emphasize would be moving in the direction of a digital business model. Picking up on some of Philip's comments, you really want to think of what's happening in the digital space. If you look at advertising, it's moving toward Facebook and moving toward Google. Mm-hmm. It's less direct mail. If you're looking at journals and magazines, those are moving also to digital subscription. Mm-hmm. The trick is going to be moving to a digital space and not being the Polaroids or the Blockbusters or the Tower Records of the world, but trying to become the Amazons and the Apples of the world.
Are you saying the U.S. Post Office should try and become an Amazon or an Apple? I mean, what is its role? When you've got Amazon and Apple and Google and on and on and on in that digital realm, do we need – is there a role for the Post Office?
Yes, actually, as a platform, it can actually become a purveyor of services for other folks, digital archiving, digital secure documents.
Why would that be the Post Office and not, you know, I mean, there's a million firms out there right now, Zoombox and all these other.
Zoombox is a great example of someone that should be partnering. Matter of fact, Zoombox already has a partnership with New Zealand's government as a white label service. Why not have them do that also for the Post Office?
But I mean, why would the Post Office be involved in that? The thing people are attached to now is their delivery of stuff to the door and picking up from the mailbox. You know, why should we even try to get the Post Office into the digital future?
Well, we want to see if we can move the direction toward digital goods and services where you can actually have a sustained revenue stream. The difficulty is that if the digitization is going to happen whether they like it or not, the trick is going to be getting the efficiencies of that. If you look at the efficiencies of something like a huge firm like General Motors, they have 200,000 employees and the market cap of $34 billion. If you look at something like Facebook, they have a market cap which is almost double that of General Motors, but only 2,000 employees. We need to see if we can capture some of those efficiencies and move them into the Post Office to save those jobs and see if we can actually help the Post Office become more like a platform where we can do some of the social marketing, we can do some of the social interaction, we can do the interaction with digital government. The U.S. Post Office could be exactly one of the sources for trying to interact with your tax records, with your driver's license, with the delivery of secure documents from the government for retirement funds.
That's interesting. Really official, secure things might be through the Post Office. Philip Hare, do you picture that? Should they be competing, you know, with other platforms on the web? Or are we in the digital era inexorably in a long sort of wrap-up, wind-down of the Postal Service?
Well, I think what my colleague has just described, actually other countries have begun doing that kind of thing. In the report we issued earlier this year, we talk about for example, in Australia, they have an e-business, e-letter business unit. They provide digital, you know, mailing opportunities. Canada Post has an online bill presentment service. In Finland, people have a free service where they can actually archive things for up to 7 years up and mail free of charge. So other countries have begun in that direction. I think the one thing that, as I think about those different kinds of models, in the U.S., our digital communications have evolved a bit differently in the sense that, you know, we're more used to working with the Verizons and providers of that nature and not necessarily looking to the Postal Service to provide a service like that. So I'd be interested in Mr. Van Alstyne's his thoughts about how that might happen, because I think that would be a pretty big cultural shift for us.
I mean, how would the Post Office ever catch up? These private industry people burdened with none of their retirement costs and all the rest, they're competing, you know, light speed, you know, hand over fist here. How do you get the Postal Service in that game?
Oh, there's no question the Post Office needs to become more nimble and more active. But I really think they need to start looking toward more business partnerships. And I realize this may have to overcome some regulatory hurdles to make this happen. If you look at government organizations like, you know, Poste Italienne, they're already in the business of banking and insurance and mobile phones, and they're relatively healthy. My colleague also mentioned, you know, the German Deutsche Post. Mm-hmm. They actually purchased the delivery company DHL.
Yeah.
So they're actually in business in addition to doing the posts. It's hard for us to ask the Post Office to run like a business if we don't also actually ask them to compete with business, if they can enter or partner with businesses. Partnerships, I think, are where they're going to get the most leverage.
Sounds like a huge gear shift, and hard to know whether they can, will ever play at that speed in this country. We've got so much response from our listeners. People really care about this issue. Philip Herr, Marshall Van Alstyne, please stand by. Alan in Mason City, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Alan. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. My suggestion is, and some of this was brought up by some of your people, that we make the Postal Service consumer-driven. And what I'm talking about is have delivery be consumer-driven. What is the most prized thing that people say about the Postal Service? I see my carrier every day. It's an important service to the public. So let's have them pay for it. Let's see how much they're willing to pay for delivery.
Well, people are already always complaining, you know, that the price of a stamp goes up and up and up. Alan, I see here that you worked for the post office for a long time, 15 years as a postmaster. You know, people already complain.
Yes, but what we would be doing is right now the rates for a first-class stamp are determined by sampling throughout the Postal Service every day, and that includes delivery. Well, let's modify that sampling to determine the rates that do not include delivery, but we would say just for a small amount a month.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this. You have over 100 million stops every day,
mm-hmm.
and if you said, oh, $3 a month, and we'll deliver. $5 a month, we'll deliver. In fact, you have a curbside box, you want door delivery, that's a little bit more.
What about grandma who can't get out to the box anymore, or who's living on Social Security and can't afford another $5 a month, or people in poverty? I mean, do we cut out, if we do that, do we cut out part of the people the post office historically has served, Alan?
Well, right now, or at least when I worked, there is a thing called hardship delivery. And if someone had a curbside box and they became elderly and they couldn't get to their box, they would have a doctor file some type of excuse, and the Postal Service would change their delivery for free, though.
So maybe we'd pay a little bit more a month and have something like that great delivery service. Alan, speaking from experience there, and I appreciate that call, Alan. Let me get one more right here. Laura in Westford, Vermont. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is Laura. I just wanted to say something a little different. I lived in Nepal in Asia for
mm-hmm.
10 years,
mm-hmm.
and where they have no postal delivery service. And I saw its effects on the society, where no electric bills could be delivered, no tax bills could be delivered. The government has no way of finding people if they need to. And I don't think we ever keep that in mind in terms of what the effect on our society is.
But Laura, isn't that different in Nepal? I mean, here we have all those electronic services.
Right. But I mean, there they don't even have an address for people.
Now that's
like,
interesting.
What would it be like if people didn't even have an address that you knew where they were?
Right. And that's Marsha Van Alstyne, what about a future where, at least now through the Postal Service, we kind of know where people are based, at least, not where they are at every moment, though that may happen too, but where their home is or how to get in touch with them. What if you go digital, do we just float away from geography and nobody knows where anybody is based?
Well, actually, a lot of the business models are moving toward mobile services. In fact, some of the post offices, I believe Canada Post is one of them, is now doing location tracking via mobile services, offering targeted ads, much as Google would be doing a location-based restaurant.
But what the heck? Is a postal mailman going to walk up to me in the middle of the day and say, oh, there you are, I'm miles from home, and he sees me and gives me my mail?
Well,
I want it at home.
Well, actually, two things. One, if they can become the digital platform, they become an arbiter between businesses trying to reach the person and also the person with the business. They can actually tap revenue as much as Apple is taking royalties on the apps that they take. But you can actually be more sophisticated than that. As people move around, you can mm-hmm. reroute mail in transit. We just had a family vacation where a family member needed a battery for a camera and needed that for the trip and had to have that rerouted. If you can do that dynamically, that's a highly prized service that you could actually add some value for.
Philip Herr, do we come unmoored from a physical base as citizens if we don't have the Postal Service?
It's an interesting question. I mean, the caller's citing the Nepal situation. I mean, there is something fundamental to the lives we live that we take for granted. And if you are in a situation like that where you don't have that kind of service, it does raise some interesting questions. But I think, Tom, your point was, you know, this whole thing is changing, and I think as it evolves, I think We're moving through this paper age into more of a digital age, but still, as that transition takes place, it's going to be a question, I think, as Marshall mentioned in his comment, about how we leverage these different things and build, you know, what will be a new business model. Putting a lot on the back of the Postal Service could be tough, but it is clearly, you know, the what this is going to look like in 10 years, I think, it's hard to anticipate now.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Mail, the U.S. Postal Service. It's right now on the brink of default. Billions it owes. It says it cannot afford to pay anymore. Congress looking at that right now. And at the longer-term future, you've got the Postmaster General talking about a death spiral, maybe default, maybe the end of service. Certainly we're in a different age. Philip Herr is with us from the General Accountability Office in Washington. He's spent a lot of time looking at the issues of the post office and how other countries do it. Marshall Van Alstyne is with us. He's at Boston University's School of Management. He's also worked with MIT Center for Digital Business, was a speaker at the Postal Vision 2020 conference recently, looking at strategies to keep the U.S. Postal Service relevant. But what do you think? Is it a must-have for this country, for this society? Is technology changing that must-have picture? Can you picture a day when there's no U.S. mail? Philip Marshall gets so much response here as a listener says, the USPS is a miracle. I can put a letter in my mailbox, and for less than a buck, someone will come to my home and deliver it to Honolulu, Baghdad, or Sapporo. I get magazines and local papers delivered to my home. So nice. On the other hand, you've got people saying, you know, here's Danielle says, I work for the Postal Service in New England. I have to tell you that 75% of what I deliver is junk. Catalogs, advertisements, credit card offers, and about 75% of the people I deliver it to don't want it. She says the USPS cannot compete. On the other hand, Christy says, I'm a postal worker in a rural area. I see people who have no bank accounts, no computers, who depend on the Postal Service each and every day. If you get rid of the Postal Service, you put the elderly and the poor at a great disadvantage, and much more. We'll look at them. Ian in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Ian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to know more about the role of junk mail and mass marketing in the budget of the Postal Service, and why do you speculate it is that UPS and FedEx don't deliver junk mail?
Okay. Philip Herr, let's come to you on that. I mean, the assertion out there is that we now essentially subsidize the delivery of junk mail, the way they have lower rates and first-class mail has higher rates. But what about their role in the fiscal picture?
Well, at this point, to Ian's question about why UPS or FedEx wouldn't do it, and I think it's really a cost question. The cost for their delivery is considerably higher than the Postal Service, so I think that would be behind that. I think if mailing organization was willing to pay the fee of whatever it might be, $10 to get it to your house, that would be driven by economics. In terms of the postal side, they say, you know, the rough numbers now are in terms of profit, it takes three pieces of that advertising mail or standard mail, as they call it, to equal the profit of a first class stamp. So, but the argument on the other side is if they raise the rates much more, that mail will leave the mail stream, so that the retailer will not send out its catalog ad or its the one page postcard type thing now that they're sending.
But are we, the U.S. Postal Service, losing money on every, pound of junk mail it sends out? It's got billions in deficit now. Sooner or later, that's going to be paid by somebody, the taxpayer, very likely. Are we, in effect, subsidizing the junk mail?
Well, I think that to some degree, there are a series of products that by the analysis of the Postal Regulatory Commission, there are classes of mail, periodicals being one, that are the technical phrasing is money losing market dominant products. So in fiscal year 2009, when we did a report, periodicals lost $642 million. To some degree, there are classes of mail that are not considered to cover their attributable costs.
So there you go, a kind of subsidy right there. Cindy in Bethel, Connecticut, you're on the air, Cindy.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
There are two things I love about the post office. One is the stamps, and the other is my mailman, Mark. But I get very frustrated. I live in a small town. They don't seem to be able to even get their terminals to work, and they're always running out of stamps. I also wanted to mention that I used to live in France in the early 90s, and they had the Minitel. I also had a savings account, a bank account at the post office called the Caisse d'Epargne, and we were looking things up on the Minitel in France in the late 80s and early 90s, and it just seems that our post office, it seems to me, they're at least a year behind everything else, and they're always playing catch-up and never getting there.
But, Cindy, every country evolves differently in the way it does things. Do you think that our postal service is critical for the future? You love your mailman. You love stamps.
I don't know. I don't want to live without stamps, and I don't want to live without Marco, but maybe it's unfortunately, maybe that's the way it's going unless they really get it together with their technology and competitiveness. I don't see it continuing.
Cindy, I appreciate your call. Here's Christine. She says, yes, we need it. Not all, and here's why. Not all Netflix choices are available by streaming. Most Amazon purchases come through the U.S. Postal Service. And I still send, she says, I still send out 50 or so Christmas cards every year, although, hello, ouch, on the cost of those stamps. I mean, can we afford, Marshall, to have it for the Netflix movies that aren't streamed, for your Amazon purchases, that does go to digital commerce, and for the, you know, kind of old-timey and absolutely wonderful sense of getting Christmas cards in the mail?
Oh, you definitely want the personal sense of that. I'm hoping that some of that stuff will never go away, and the packaging, of course, will never go away. I wanted to pick up on one thing the previous caller just said about France. They've actually done a couple of very clever things going backwards from some digital concepts back to physical concepts. They've been using their spare capacity in post to keep things surviving to actually have the postman check on the elderly, so you could actually pay an extra service and have them check on your parents. The postman's already at the house. They're already doing meter reading at the time. They're doing delivery of medications in there. They're taking an idea of the spare capacity borrowed from organizations like Amazon, who is doing digital, you know, delivery of books and goods, and also managing their inventories. They then, with all this excess capacity, started offering hosted computer services, software as a service, other goods and services with that spare capacity. So one of the things France is doing is using their spare capacity to keep the things, to keep the mail running with these extra services.
Philip Herr, is Washington thinking in those kind of, you know, let's mix it up and reimagine what it might be terms? Sometimes I feel like, you know, we narrow it down to this conversation about will we have a postal service or not, and will it still seem like 1947, or could it be something new? Is there a flexible, wide-ranging conversation, a real one, going on in Washington?
Well, I think people have talked about the idea of moving things into the post office. You know, what could they do? One thing they do now, for example, is take passport applications. That's a real, and they don't. That's not at every post office, but it's at select post offices. The other, I think, you know, the conversation kind of go the other way. It goes is, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Tom, is moving it out into retail partnerships. And so, I guess one of the questions would be, I guess one way I think about it is, so what would you put into a post office you're not able to readily purchase now? And so, for example, you know, cell phones are sometimes mentioned. And usually, when I think of that, I usually wonder, well, is it a problem to buy a cell phone now? And so I think generally it's not. So I think it could go either way. One, you could try to bring more things in. I know in some of the posts that we visited, it's been somewhat of a challenge to bring some of those, you know, selling computers, selling other kinds of things at a post office.
May I interrupt? Just say that just sounds unimaginable to me. I mean, people are selling computers and cell phones every time you turn around. The idea that the post office will compete. There are important things they do, but, I mean, it's like we're trying to make up jobs for them when you get to that.
Right. Well, so I think thus the thing about, you know, if there's a diminished demand for, you know, purchasing stamps and things of that nature, then might it not be more cost effective to say, like in Canada, they put it into a pharmacy. And here in the U.S., this exists. My parents live in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
In the town, there are two post offices. And at one of the supermarkets, there is what they call a contract postal unit, where you can, until, you know, 8 or 10 o'clock at night, get your postal services with the exception of express mail. So it's already here to some degree.
But do you see enough dynamic flexibility in the thinking about this in Washington for a good solution to emerge? Or is it going to be just stick with what we've got and then beg for federal money to keep it going?
Well, if people are not willing to, you know, one of the issues that the Postal Service has said is that 80% of post offices don't have enough revenue to cover their costs. So it begs the question of either are you able to make it more dynamic and bring in more services, or do you find a way to, you know, basically put it somewhere else, you know, and give it a small corner of a retail store where, you know, there's branding, people can see that that's where you get the postal stuff. But that's part of this dialogue and discussion that people are beginning to have. But, you know, in the meantime, there's a lot of concern about small towns. I mean, one of your callers earlier
absolutely
referenced this, you know, what I like to think of as a digital divide. I mean, there are, you know, I think in the sphere that many of us live and work in, you know, we tend to forget that, you know, about a third of the population doesn't have access to, you know, the internet, and, you know, for different, maybe sometimes for preference, sometimes for economic reasons. So
rural free delivery was a big deal back in the day, and for many, still a big deal now. Amir in Boston, Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Amir, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question and one and a comment. Is that first? My question is, I'm curious how much First, a comment, I guess. I think that the Postal Service is held to this weird standard where it is micromanaged by Congress constantly, but it's also told, you know, compete with private sector sort of businesses.
Right.
But it's not given the flexibility and nimbleness. And so I'm wondering what costs are sort of imposed by that, by the management of Congress. And also the sort of mandates they give, saying, you know, media mail has to be cheaper. And, I mean, you talked about periodicals and stuff like that.
But let me ask you, Amir, maybe Congress reflects the will of the people. The congressmen are reluctant to close down little post office outlets. People in those towns don't want them closed down. Congress is reluctant to stop Saturday delivery. You know, is this just responding to democracy, Amir?
Well, I mean, that's one thing, but then saying that the whole system is broken when it's actually being tugged at both ends. It's not held to the same standards that a business is held to on one end, but it's held to the same standards of profitability that it is on the other.
Yeah, that is very true, and that is a tough position to be in. Let me hold that for a moment and go to Pat in Burlington, Vermont. Pat, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I've enjoyed all of the previous comments, and there's no institution that doesn't have some room for improvement. My main focus is on the labor issue, and I think this is kind of has not been really brought to public attention. The focus is on, you know, the question of can it compete with email, et cetera. But the reality is that the Postal Service, I believe, is the second largest employer in the nation, and it has probably the largest labor union of any organization. And I'm concerned about this, you know, sub rosa effort to kill unions across the nation, and I feel that the post office might well fall into that effort.
Yes, I hear you loud and clear, though. They wrapped up a pretty good contract earlier this year, we hear, and yes, they're number two right after Walmart. But let me ask, and I totally understand that. I mean, the idea we're talking about maybe getting rid of another 100,000-plus jobs out of the Postal Service at a time like this with so many people unemployed, that's rough. But let me ask you, Pat, can we keep the Postal Service going as a jobs program? Does that really make sense?
Well, I have spoken with people who work in the post office, and they have indicated to me that the post office could survive, that they are not really economically, you know, deficient at the moment, but what has put them into this bind is this upfront payment, $5.5 billion, and I think they claim that $6.9 billion at least is owed to them by the federal government. And what I'm wondering is, you know, are we looking at the wrong problem in terms of, you know, this immediate crisis?
Let us pick it up right there, Pat. Philip, what about it? That 5.5 something a year billion.
Right.
Is that an effort to put a spike in the post office, or is that a legitimate payment for future retirement costs?
Well, that is part of the 2006 Act, the Postal Reform Act. That was a deal struck to pre-fund retiree health care costs with, you know, basically, with the thinking that the Postal Service is, you know, its business model is going to be challenged in the future. So the goal there and the thought there is to pre-fund those costs. I would, you know, ask folks to consider that the estimate for what those costs are in the future is around $100 billion, as estimated by OPM, the Office of Personnel Management's actuaries. The Postal Service has pre-funded about $42.5 billion of that now. It is a high bar. We acknowledge that in our work. We think that payment we know it's been difficult for the Postal Service to make. We believe they should pre-fund as much as they can, given those large obligations, because as a large employer, it has a number of people that are expecting those benefits to accrue to them as well.
So I guess I'm trying to figure out if it's a reasonable thing to be paid, but yet they can't afford to pay it. Where does that leave us?
Well, there needs to be some middle ground. I mean, they set up a very aggressive 10-year schedule to make those payments, and I think at the time in 2006, as we think back about 2006 when this was done, that was what now appears to be the peak of mail volume, about 213 billion pieces. We're now down to about 170. Mm-hmm. So, what's a realistic way to do that? In a report we've done, we laid out a couple different ways you could consider that. But pre-funding benefits for those individuals it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's at this point it's a burden. It's a heavy burden for them.
Well, pay now or pay later. The people want their mail. Marshall, what do you think? Look out 10, 20 years. Will we have a postal service? Is it an open question? Could this country operate without one?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm sure the Postal Service will exist in one form or another, particularly if we want universal coverage and services of that sort. I mean, to some sense, if you want to answer that question, history is repeating itself. This has actually happened before. Most folks may not realize it, but the original source of Wells Fargo and American Express is that they were competing, taking away the most profitable business in the local routes and the intercity delivery. Mm-hmm. Congress stepped in order to guarantee universal coverage, stepped in and gave them rights to deliver certain mail. And that was a good policy because we got, as one of the earlier callers had mentioned, the woman who'd been in Nepal, we have the ability to reach everyone in the population. We have the ability to reach everyone.
Which is a wonderful thing.
Which is fantastic. It's absolutely wonderful. But there are some solutions. There are some things that we can do, moving things forward. Again, with I think digital government is a particularly promising area where they have unique access to the government and actually help create platforms for distributing information from the government. Another opportunity, Post Italian, for example, Nokia is pre-installing Post Italian apps on their smartphones to route business through Post Italian. We can do much the same thing if there are useful services that the government can provide through those smartphones and mobile devices.
Big challenges right in front of the Postal Service right now, and a big need to think in a very broad-minded way about how technology and need and jobs meet in this new era. We're grateful to you two for being with us to help us do that. Marshall Van Alstyne with the Boston University School of Management, thank you so much for being here.
Tom, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Philip Herr with the GAO in Washington, thank you, Mr. Herr.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.